Welcome to the 18th episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. I'm the co-founder of Reckless Dice and your host, Jesse Gitzman Burke. With me tonight, our local Maple Leaf giant from the north, I think that grew since last time, Lester Crow and his strolling bones. And of course, our ever-famous or infamous Codan the Barbarian.
Glad to be back.
You guys ready for a good show?
Yes. Oh,
always, man.
Excellent.
Man,
well, let's kick it off with some news then.
Why does my title keep fucking growing, man?
Because I
decided to disclaimer.
On, man.
I think you should be using commas in there. Otherwise, this becomes a Maple Leaf Giant of the North.
It's true. And I hate the Maple Leafs. I'm a Habs fan, but that's all right.
Beaver-loving.
Beaver-loving.
Habs fan.
I am.
You did, just before we started recording, profess your ever-dying. Ever-dying? No. Undying.
Undying.
Never-dying. Undying love. For your furry companions.
Yes, I love the furry beaver.
He loves the beavers.
So what's new in the last 2 weeks, guys?
Not a lot here. I got sick. I've been really ill over the last couple days, so...
I was more looking in the Warhammer world, not really your...
Oh!
Yeah, not your personal life. Come on, we don't care about that.
Nurgle. So we had the secret societies in the feature news, and Minions of Slaanesh both were released over the last 2 weeks. Those are two new featured articles on the homepage. What did you guys think of those two articles? Did you guys get a chance to read them?
I read the one. I didn't really read the Minions one. I'm assuming that one's talking about the different chaos creatures related to Slaanesh. But I did read the Secret Societies, and I think that sounds really interesting.
The Minions of Slaanesh one, well, for both of them, for that matter, were really light on content.
Mm-hmm.
There are three small sections. The Minions one very, very lightly alluded to a few of the demons you might be facing, particularly the demonettes of Slaanesh, but really just kind of talked about how it would be focusing some on social actions and adversaries, kind of the power and allure of why someone might follow Slaanesh, and kind of the focusing a bit on that being driven to perfection style that, you know, Slaanesh embodies. And then the Secret Societies one really kind of took a similar but slightly different focus on the same topic. Kind of talked how it did mention that there were going to be some fleshed out rules and backstory on several different Slaaneshi cults, and, you know, why somebody might want to join one, how the players can get involved in them. And then, of course, I'm assuming, therefore, that the adventure is going to be centering around a Slaaneshi cult and the political intrigue around it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me like you'll probably get a few different Game Master-oriented sheets that are similar to the ones in the Witch's Song that are all about, like, you know, how into a specific one.
The organization cards?
Yeah, I have a feeling that there'll be something similar to that. I mean, I don't know how many they said. They said there were like five groups or something like that they're going to detail. But yeah, the Secret Societies thing seems interesting. I'm really curious as to how this one's going to...
So now that the Slaaneshi supplement, the Lure of Power, is it's getting a little closer now. We know quite a bit about what we can probably expect. Do we want to try and cover what we're expecting, or we'll kind of place our bets on what we're going to get inside the package?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
What do you guys think? Obviously we're going to get the two books. One's going to be the Slaaneshi book, which they've already titled the Liber Ecstatica.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other book will be, actually it might even, well, I don't think it'll be called the Lore of Power book, but it'll, there will be the second book. So one will focus specifically on the Slaanesh, side of chaos, the cults, the really kind of the fluff book as they've coined it, or as they put out in previous supplements. The other book will likely be half adventure and then half rules. So what kind of new rules are we thinking we're going to see here?
Well, mostly I'm assuming it's going to be social oriented and more so gold tier related things. That's kind of kind of what they've alluded to. So maybe we'll see some more esoteric items, or like high-priced items, possibly. I don't really know what to expect from this. That's the thing about Slaanesh. Slaanesh is kind of... That's the one that's the hardest to pin, I guess.
Well, we do know we're going to get 10 new careers.
Yeah.
They've said that.
Yep.
So we know we can expect a variety of gold tier, I guess, politicians, electrocounts, maybe not electrocounts, but a variety of their those kind of political stations throughout the empire, high level merchants, guild masters, things like that. I think it's safe to assume that we're going to get Slaaneshi mutations because those have come in every other Chaos box.
Yeah.
We'll of course have the tokens from the new adventure. We'll have Slaaneshi Chaos Magic.
Oh, the creature cards too.
Creature cards. Yeah. Let's see. We'll probably have some new, maybe some new insanities or something like that to kind of complement the, to kind of flush out the Slaaneshi side of those. Cause hasn't each one has kind of offered some kind of insanity or some kind of a long lasting effects to go on players aside from mutations.
Mm-hmm. I would love to see some sort of drug related thing or some sort of,
I would too. Has there been any hint that we'd see it yet?
Not yet. No. I mean, apart from the fact that it's Slaanesh and it's all about like excess and sensation and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just like the halfling things. I'm still hoping.
I was going to say, are you still holding out hope for those?
I'm hoping for that. I mean, I don't think it would be very hard for them to include something like that. I mean, if you look in the main rule book, the write-ups on each of the different races are actually relatively small. They're really concise though. Like they gather all the necessary information together, but
it's very easy for them to put them in. I think that's what you're kind of saying. I mean, it's not like it's going to take a whole book to explain the halflings. I would really like to see halflings come in.
I think a page at most. It would take a page at most for them to throw in halflings. I mean, they just need to note a halfling can be any human career, like bar these. But I don't know. They haven't really said anything. They haven't even hinted at that. And I think that that's a big enough announcement that they'd probably hint at something like that if it were to be there.
Yeah, I think the reality of it being in there is really, really slim at this point, even though it'd be fun. I think my personal opinion is the best we can hope for regarding halflings is that they will periodically be thrown into an adventure as an NPC, and they will probably not be a playable race for a little while still.
Now, what would you say if possibly maybe like the Libra Fanatica came out with an expansion on their own where they just created the lore of the halflings? I mean, I would use it. I mean, wouldn't you feel comfortable using it, or would you just wait until...
There's already... I think somebody already came
Jay,
up with...
Jay Hafner. Right? Yeah, he's got a house rules, a PDF of house rules that he has, and he has halflings included.
He popped that out within, like, the first couple weeks of the game coming out, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think that, you know... So that's the one thing is, this game is all about the expansion of the Empire, and sometimes Fantasy Flight's not going to cover every... race, because some races are not as popular as others. Halflings, I mean, they kind of, you know,
if you halflings look, are wildly unpopular,
exactly.
except for the few people who feverishly adore them.
Exactly.
And then there's the completionist people, kind of like Lester and myself, who are just kind of upset that we don't have the option.
Well, I just think because it's a role-playing game, I mean, to offer that as an option makes sense. I mean, why have two different races of elves and not include halflings? That just seems that, kind of odd.
Yeah,
to me.
That does seem odd. Well, also over the last few days, Dan and I went down to Pacificon, which is a convention in the just south of San Francisco, out here in California, and we went on for about 2.5 days of solid gaming and got a ton of Warhammer roleplay in.
Yes.
Dan, you want to give us a little overview of Pacificon? You've been going to that for quite a few years. This was my first time.
Yeah, I've been going to Pacificon, geez, I think for about maybe 10 years. It's growing. I mean, as you saw, it's actually in Santa Clara. You know, the RPG scene, I think that they're just starting to expand. When they first started, RPGs were not as big at that convention, but they've started to slowly grow. I know that you guys got put on a list, but then... You know, we were doing a game, so you decided to stay. They're slowly starting to expand. But Jesse and I, we went and we actually met a couple people, some fans of the Reckless Dice. And
yeah, we did have a couple people track us down. I wore my shirt on Saturday and someone ran up and he's like, "You know, hey, Reckless Dice." And I'm like, yeah. We ended up playing a couple games later that day.
Exactly.
So, that was fun.
It was fun, and Jesse's girlfriend got really, really into her character when we decided to play a small session, which I played a wood elf, and she was some Norse woman, I guess.
Yeah, she's the one who plays Helga Kirkhoff in our in some of the adventures that you guys have that we posted, like Blackfire Pass. The Sweet Marrow adventure and the Witch's Song.
Yeah, so apparently Helga has a thing for her little goat named Rob. And apparently if you make any threats to Rob, she gets very, very angry and takes it into the RPG world. So I, in a joking manner, was making fun of, you know, killing Rob and barbecuing him and sharing it with the dwarf. And he thought it was funny, but she didn't think it was. So so we actually played a small little session. And for the life of me, every time I play with you, Jesse, I always seem to roll chaos stars. It's just like the chaos icon.
Statistically, there's a 1 in 8 chance every time you roll a single purple die. And you guys generally roll tons. So you should be. I did feel there were a lot in that particular session. But It was a good one. There was a lot of good. What we did is we played an excerpt from the Gathering Storm second adventure, which is the one where the undead begin to rise. So I was in the mood for a zombie adventure, so I kind of tailored the opening scene of that to do a zombie attack in a small village in the inn where these guys were all sleeping. And so we had a lot of fun playing through that and kind of got everybody familiar with the rules who hadn't played before. And then following that, Layla, my girlfriend, took on the task of doing her first GMing session, and she played through the Winds of Magic adventure, which I got to play, and one of the other guys, some of our other fans, got to play.
Yeah,
so and that was a blast.
It was a lot of fun. You know, it was Jesse called us the bickering children because during this session, I decided to break into Helga's room, and she decided to, because of her, you know, she was having a bad dream because she was afraid of Rob, her little goat, and I startled her. She stabbed me with her pitchfork, and basically it was kind of like two little children in the backseat of a car slapping each other, and it took the dwarf to basically tell us to, hey, we got zombies. Let's focus on those. We wanted to push each other down the stairs. It was kind of funny. Jesse had some laughs, but it was great. I had a fun time. It was awesome being able to see you guys and do a session. It was really, really fun.
Cool. Well, also speaking of getting recognized and having some fun with the podcast, we Lester, do you want to tell us a little bit about how Facebook's doing? Because that's really taken off over the last 2 weeks.
Well, it's doing excellent so far. We're getting quite a good response from people. And I don't know, we're up there with some likes and stuff. It's so weird to me calling people likers.
I'm having a hard time with that.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. I think Facebook needs to reassess their...
It was recently changed to likes from something else. What did it used to be called? Fans?
Fans. Sure.
That sounds appropriate.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was subscribers. Yeah, subscriber.
Okay. That's YouTube.
No, this one had it. I think Facebook had it, too. I'm not sure. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. Yeah, Facebook's a strange social medium, but it's a really good way to create community. And pretty much everybody is on Facebook. People have been starting to kind of come over from the Fantasy Flight forums onto the Facebook. And I've been trying to put up a question every week, but I think that the format needs to be changed a little bit. So I think
we did do our first question 2 weeks ago. Yeah,
we've done two questions as of now, but I was just kind of toying with it in the first place, and I asked what the favorite what everybody's favorite miscast effect was. And I just asked last Monday, I put one up which asked everybody what their favorite adventure, their third edition adventure specifically was, and I listened.
Did we get enough feedback to have a consensus?
Well, I think we got 11 responses to it. 11 people voted, and it seems like the Witch's Song wins hands down with 5 of those 11 votes. which is pretty good. I mean,
which is
you're happy because you voted for that one. But anyway,
only Dan laughed at that. No, but, actually, I really like Witch's Song. I'm only halfway through it, and I voted for it. I've read 4 out of the 5 chapters in it, and it is a really a nice adventure. I think the second runner up was probably the Eye for an Eye campaign, right?
Well, it was tied with Horror of Heugadal and Eye for an Eye.
I have purposefully not even touched Horror of Heugadal because Nurgle's my favorite, and I want to actually play in that one.
All right, well, I have no idea
what happens in that adventure.
I would absolutely love to run that adventure. So one of these days,
you've been telling me that now for 18 episodes.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, but I mean, it's in Canada, right? You can't even ship a t-shirt to Canada, so let's not worry about playing a game. Anyway.
Speaking of t-shirts.
Yes, actually, speaking of t-shirts.
You know, we do have the Reckless Dice t-shirt, and I think we'd love to find a way to give one away to one of our loyal and lucky fans.
Yeah, I think that would be an excellent opportunity to you know, get some Reckless Dice recognition out there. Some recklessness. Never mind. I don't know.
It is actually a cool shirt. It is worthy of wearing it in any normal occasion.
Jesse,
I've worn it out without being embarrassed. It's classy. At least I think
hey,
so.
Hey, I think what you got, like, what, 10 beers at the bar? Maybe 15 people winked at you. You even got one pat on the butt.
KublaCon was a success with the shirt.
Yes,
yeah.
It was.
Well, you could.
I attribute all of that success to the shirt.
Although, you did make the waitress very upset. Because that she didn't like you for some reason. I think maybe
PacificCon, she did not like us.
We had a bad waitress experience. So Jesse thought it would be hilarious when we gave her the bill. We literally just got up and kind of moseyed out whistling while we were going.
We gave her a tip. It just wasn't. It was the you didn't do a good job tip.
Yeah. Well, how long did it take you? It took you like, what, 35 minutes to get your drinks. And then you asked for water. And that took her a while to get. So, yeah.
But, so, if the waitress is listening to Reckless Dice Podcast out here, shame on you. I doubt she is.
Shame on you.
Shame
on you. If anybody knows said waitress, shame on you as well for associating yourself with her. So, what we're thinking of doing, Lester, do you want to run through our kind of a creative brief for this little contest we're going to run?
Yeah, well, I was thinking, because Jesse originally thought that it would be a good idea to do fan art, and I definitely agree. I think that would be sweet, but I think that kind of...
Let's expand it to kind of like a creative contribution.
Yeah, because I think that fan art kind of...
And Simat, yes, you're already registered.
It puts some people on the off, because not everybody like myself has a good artistic hand. I can write very well. So what I was thinking what we do is... We have people send us in a piece. It can be art. It can be a write-up, but it has to be creative in some sort of way. You can't
just... like a one-page adventure, a full-blown adventure, fan art of the show, fan art of characters, fan art from just Warhammer in general.
Yeah, something creative that has to do with recklessness and Warhammer Fantasy roleplay. So it could be a video. It could be... a recording, it could be a picture, it could be a write-up, something like that. And then between the three of us...
You could even write a poem about how Dan, the Codan the Barbarian's adventures might unfold.
Yes!
Yes, yes, that would be really good,
too. He came from native lands. And I can't do that whole little gesture thing.
Yeah, but I just think that some sort of creative contribution creates something that has to do with recklessness and Warhammer Fantasy roleplay, and then the three of us will kind of come to a consensus decision. And I think we should announce the winner on episode 20, which gives people a month to create stuff and put it up to send it to us. And you can send it to us through all the standard channels.
You know, someone's going to be pulling their hair out on like the last day trying to get thing in. It's going to be hilarious. Yeah.
And are we going to allow, I mean, not that we could really govern this, but I mean, a lot of people may already have some content that was recently written or recently created that fits the bill. As long as it's something that you guys have done that you feel proud of, that's a contribution to the community of Warhammer, and you want to get it, you want to get it out there and maybe give it a little bit of press and talk about it. This would be a great chance for you guys to submit some of your content and get some nice positive feedback from the community. So we'll help pimp it for you.
Yeah.
And then we'll choose a winner. And then we will we'll get a shirt printed for you and ship it out to you, no cost.
And Jesse, you should almost put up a picture of the shirt, or at least the logo.
I was thinking about it. Well, the new logos are all up on the Reckless Dice website.
Okay.
Those you can see up on the banner, and all the logos on Twitter and Facebook and everything have been swapped out too. It has the two dice, and then the cool Reckless Dice font. Yeah,
but then we have nice to shirt. Put. What were you saying about shipping concerns, though? Like,
let's. I think I apologize to anybody international from the U.S. I think we're going to keep the mailing just because we are not
fully
that
funded.
Well off that we're not funded in any way except for our basements that we will we're going to keep the shipping restrictions to within the U.S. If somebody wins who is outside the U.S., we'll try and find something else suitable as a prize or a gift for you.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe work out some sort of shipping deal with them or whatever.
Yeah, we'll figure it.
We will have to figure something out for that. But that comes from being fans, like basement fans, like you said. We're not rolling in the dough, that's for sure. Although, Dan, you're new and graduated. You should be... banking money right now.
Aren't you in a Fortune 500 company now, Dan?
That's
Dan, aren't you in the gold tier now?
I am. You guys are my employers. Why are we going through this conversation again? Didn't we have this conversation way, way, way back when? We're done.
Our last bit of news is me. I just want to tell you guys and beg for your support. I'm going to be running in a something called a Tough Mudder this Sunday, which is the September 18th. Which is an 11-mile off-road obstacle course death march thing, with fire, brimstone, and electric wires. And so I'm going to be doing that at 9:20 Sunday morning. I'm very excited. And so anyway, any support you guys want to give me, shoot out some tweets, and we'll give me some level of encouragement. I would love to hear it.
Yeah, he's doing it as a test of his toughness score.
That's right. I'm going to try and get it from a 2 to a 3.
That's awesome. Hey, one thing I noticed.
They recommend a toughness of 5, so.
Oh, geez. I would fail so bad. I wish you luck, man. One thing I noticed, though, is that I didn't announce the new question, and this fits in with our theme for this episode.
Cool, let's do it.
So on Facebook, I'll post this after we're done recording here. The new question will be concerning winds of magic, and it will be, what is your favorite wind of magic?
And we're back. So our first main topic of the episode is going to be the magic rules, pretty much what has come out since the original episode 6, where we talked in detail about how to be a wizard and how to be a faith caster or priest. There have been some expanded rules that are also available for casters. We wanted to go over those, bring you guys up to speed on witchcraft, hedge magic, scrolls, potions, inscribe spells, and the like. And then following that, we are going to get into the magical fluff of the Warhammer world. So Lester, let's kick it off.
All right. So in episode 6, we touched mostly on the mechanics of being a spellcaster. So using spellcraft and channeling skills to generate power and cast spells. In Winds of Magic, there are a few expanded rules that we kind of left by the wayside. And the main ones here are concerning attuned items and learning other spells or using things like warpstone. So
what is an attuned item?
Well, an attuned item is pretty much carried by every single wizard, and it basically allows them to channel a little bit better, cast their spells slightly better. So it could be anything from a staff to gray wizards are known to carry swords. They call them swords of judgment. And they
like talismans or orbs or like hourglasses or like kind of any kind of like magical item that you carry around.
And as they enhance, as they climb the ranks of the colleges, their attuned items become more, I don't want to say gaudy, but they add things to them constantly to make them more powerful, I guess.
Almost and, like that.
Yeah, exactly. And basically it just assists with their spell casting. The rules in here are pretty straightforward, I guess. It's pretty common sense stuff as far as it talks more about how you can personalize your particular attuned items. And then there's a lot of rules on that in the original Magic, not supplement, but the Tome of Mysteries, it was called.
And do they add dice to your channeling, or is it your spellcraft?
I do believe that it is for channeling, and I believe you get a white dice for it. I believe. Don't
yep, that's right.
Don't take me 100%.
I just started my wizard character, so I do recall that pain.
I believe it's one white dice, and it gets better as you climb in the ranks, as you get higher and add things to your attuned item. But that's something that every wizard is. It says in the rules that the game master should allow every wizard to start with an attuned item, or that should be the focus of like the first adventure to get them an attuned item. It kind of gives them a little bit of a flair and a little bit of a bonus, because casting magic can be very, very, very dangerous. Other ways that you can enhance your ability to cast spells within the game are using things called luck stones, which are actually very rare. They're only made by the most powerful of wizards, and they allow you to kind of look into the future almost and perceive the changes in the winds of magic, and it helps you kind of curb the whole miscast thing slightly. It basically allows you to re-roll one single dice in any spellcraft check once per week, it says. So I would limit that to once per session, or, you know, as per how the adventures are rolling out. You can also use wands. Wands, they store power within them, so you're only allowed to have twice your willpower in power at any one time before really bad stuff can start to happen to your wizard. And a wand actually allows you to carry more power. I believe it can be upwards of one per wizard rank of the wizard who created the wand. Scrolls also store spells in them. But once again, in Warhammer, magical items are actually very, very, very rare. They're only created by the most powerful of wizards, and a scroll will actually have a spell written into it. And anybody, even Helga, the Kislevian goat farmer, she could even make an attempt if she learned how to read and became literate. She could make an attempt. So any non-magic using character can use a scroll, but it's much, much, much more difficult. It's
little do you know, Helga has aspirations of becoming a caster.
Oh, I know that. I've listened to the podcasts, but it adds two challenge dice, but you also suffer corruption galore if you roll chaos stars on that, and it's very, very difficult. So even if the spell were already three challenge dice, it would be five challenge dice for you to try to read a scroll if you weren't a person who was attuned to magic. And then there's also the ever wonderful warp stone, which fuels my favorite Skaven spells. And what that does is it allows you to add expertise dice to channeling checks. It really allows you to generate power like crazy, upwards of three dice.
Three yellow dice.
Yeah, three expertise dice, depending on how big it is. Obviously, if it's like a large piece of warpstone, it can help you immensely. Yeah,
eating warpstone's tremendously healthy for humans, right?
No, it's terribly bad, because what happens is as soon as you've made the channeling check, you have to roll a daunting or four difficulty discipline check. And if you fail, you suffer a corruption, and then you suffer an additional corruption for every chaos star generated. And humans are generally not very resistant to corruption.
Yeah, you're only able to take a number of corruption points equal to your toughness, right?
Before you start, it's five. I believe it's five plus your toughness.
Okay. Yeah, so that's what, like, not that's going to be what,
eight
points on average for a human.
Yeah, so that's really bad. And then you start really like mutating. You start getting eyes in your throat and things like that.
And there's also corruption rules just for the basic consumption of warpstone or even exposure to it. Like having it in your pocket is going to be bad news bears.
Yeah, even if you walk into a cavern that has a little bit of it, you could suffer corruption, which is that's pretty much the main source of mutation is corruption in the world.
So the two things that I'm interested in on these expanded magic rules are the prescribed spells and then learning to cast spells that are particularly high rank. Can you go over those?
Yeah, so they kind of touched on it a little bit in their standard rules about learning like higher level spells. And they basically stated that you had to spend an additional advancement for each level higher than your current rank. So if you were trying to learn a rank 2 wizard spell and you were only rank 1, it would cost you 2 advancements to learn that spell. But it also increases the difficulty by 1 challenge dice per rank. And for every Chaos Star you roll, you suffer corruption, basically.
That's to cast the spell? Or to
learn? It says here that, for example, a rank 1 wizard can acquire a rank 3 spell, but it would cost them 3 advances and 2 additional challenge dice to any pool that he tries. It just increases the miscast chance.
Okay.
But you can learn spells of a higher rank. It just costs you more advances, and it is immensely more dangerous to attempt to cast those spells. And if you want to learn forbidden things, which is really interesting, in Winds of Magic, they describe the ability to learn dark magic as one of the specific orders. So you can actually cast any of the Tzeentch spells, any of the Chaos spells, any of the dark magic spells, if you take this as a talent. The problem is with forbidden studies or trying to learn a spell outside of one's school of magic.
So we'll get into the schools of magic and why you're focused into a single one in our next session.
Yeah. So if you try to learn a spell outside of it, what you have to do immediately once you try to learn it, you have to find a wizard or a grimoire, which is a book, or something that has this information in it, and then you have to attempt, and it can take, it's depending on the GM, it can take anywhere from a few days to a few months to learn these spells. But you have to attempt a daunting spellcraft check with 1 misfortune dice per rank of spell being researched. And regardless of if it succeeds or fails, you suffer 1 corruption for every Chaos Star generated within the check. And then if you try to cast the spell, you have to add 2 challenge dice to it every time you try to cast that. So you could technically,
even after you've learned it and you've become a sufficient rank.
Yep. You could technically be a bright wizard and attempt to cast a gray wizard spell or attempt to cast some sort of dark magical spell, but it is significantly more dangerous for miscasting and corruption purposes. But I think that pretty much covers it off.
Then the only thing that was that we hadn't really covered was hedge magic or witchcraft, which was introduced in The Witch's Song. And that generally operates very similar to any other College of Magic or Wind of Magic, except that it has, instead of an order card or talent card that you'd socket on your character sheet, it has a witchcraft talent card. And the witchcraft talent card operates in a manner where you have the option at any point of suffering a corruption point to add a yellow die to a spellcraft check. So that seems like a really, really heavy price to pay for that die. But, there it is.
Unless you want to grow a tentacle, that's a really fast way of growing a tentacle.
Hey, yep. Tentacles are in style these days.
But when we get back, we're going to cover a bit of magic in the Warhammer Old World. We'll cover a brief history, perspective of wizards, the colleges, and the whole shebang.
We're going to give you the goodies.
And we are back. We are here to talk about the winds of magic in the Warhammer Old World. Magic is a huge part of the Warhammer world, both from a Chaos perspective, Empire perspective, Wizard perspective, creation of the world, Chaos energies, and everything. I think what we're really going to focus on in this particular session is Chaos within the, Magic within the Empire and its Colleges of Magic. But I think we should first give a brief history on the Empire's, kind of how magic came about in the Empire. Now, Lester, I know you know quite a bit about this, doing the more recent Techless creation of the world's video on that you put up on the Facebook page.
Basically, as I understand the history of magic in the old world, I mean, magic's always been practiced. The theory is that the gates at the poles collapsed along like thousands and thousands of years ago and leaked chaos energy into the world. And then the high elves basically created a vortex that funnels it off back out into the void or whatever you want to call the chaos realm.
Realm of chaos.
Yeah. And then these winds they're basically, it's energy that pours from these rifts in reality, these tears in reality that are at the poles of the Warhammer Old World.
And the High Elves have pretty much mastered the various winds, and collectively the mastery of all those winds at once is what the High Elves call high magic.
Yeah, you can liken it to white light, and then humans see it more as though they were looking through a prism where they can only see an individual light. But as far as history is concerned, people have been practicing it ever since chaos started leaking into the Old World. You'd have your random shamans, you know, in their little huts, making their little spells and bending magic to whatever pathetic ways they could. But it wasn't until, I believe it was in 2302.
Wow, you actually know the date. It was the first Chaos War.
Well, the second Chaos War.
The second Chaos War.
The great incursion or whatever. I believe it was 2302, Imperial calendar. And that's when Magnus the Pious, mm-hmm. he led like an army to thwart chaos as chaos just came pouring down from the north into the empire, but it was pretty much hopeless. So the empire sent a man to go to Ulthuan, which is the isle where the elves live, and to beseech them for help. But they were being attacked by all sorts of things. So they could only manage to lend three wizards. And the main wizard was, his name's Teclis. And he basically came and helped he taught humans magic, but he had to teach them almost like you would teach a child something very simple, you know, by like repetition and teaching them more simple forms of it. And then they used this newfound power to thwart chaos.
And it was likened to the high magic was, like we said, the full prism of magic, and mm-hmm. and the elves who had mastered this over a lifetime and deemed that humans in their short lifetime in comparison could never fully understand all the winds of magic at once. So Teclis decided that was only, you know, applicable for a human to be able to master one of the winds, and that is why any human is really only allowed access to one at a time, in addition to their affiliation with the colleges.
Yeah, and he found that they were so susceptible to corruption that he didn't want them to have access to the more dangerous melding of the magics together.
Now and Magnus the Pious is also the one responsible for founding the eight winds of college, or the eight colleges that practice each of the eight winds of magic, which are, most of the main colleges are in Altdorf itself, the capital of the empire, with the exception of one or two of them, which are in the outskirts just outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's you want to quickly go over what each of these eight magics are. And why somebody might want to practice a particular one?
Yeah, well, you've got eight, right? So there's mm-hmm. eight colleges that could have to do with the eight different winds of magic. And they call them winds, but really it's energy, and it's metaphysical energy. You can't really feel it or actually see it, and it isn't actually the color that they describe it as. These are just metaphysical ways so that people who can't perceive them can kind of get a grasp at least.
Now, on some level, though, if a wizard were to use his magic sight and actually see mm-hmm. these winds of magic and the magical energies, they do actually appear mm-hmm. Often in this kind of color. You know, for example, the Amber Order, which is the lore of beasts, has, you know, an amber hue to it.
Mm-hmm. It's more of a metaphysical thing, though. It's like magical sight is not actual physical sight. It's using it's almost like being psychic to a degree. But yeah, the Amber Order.
You know, I'm not sure that's right, because in several of the adventures I'd played in, particularly in second edition, where if you cast magic sight, and let's say the area was strong in Nurgle energy, for example, you would see all these little like you know, little maggots crawling around the ground with little faces and, like, you know, eating themselves whole and popping as you walk around on them. And none of that's actually happening in the physical world. It's purely the the chaos energies, you know, manifesting themselves in, like, visions.
Exactly, but they're having visions, like, metaphysically as opposed to physically. They're not, you don't, like the wind.
It's like seeing the ghost world. It's like seeing a ghost.
Yeah.
But you see it, but you see it not with your eyes. You see it with your mind. Is basically how
it's not affecting your sight. It's affecting your perception. It's not what you're physically seeing. It's what's seen in your mind. Mm-hmm. I guess is what you're trying to say.
Exactly.
I can live with that.
So you've got the lore of beasts and the wind. The amber wind is called Gur. I think I'm really bad at these pronunciations, but
they are a little tough to pronounce. I'm going to go with Gur. I like the Gur because it sounds like an animal.
Yeah, totally like Gur. but they call these guys they're shamans, right? And they have the ability to transform their shape. So within the actual game itself, a Warhammer Fantasy roleplay, they can beast form. They can transform into like a wolf or a bear or something like that. And they tend to be a little bit more shaggy and unkempt and uncivilized.
Very much so. They're very, very primal.
And they're one of the ones that don't have a college, like an actual headquarters in Altdorf. They kind of
commune in the forest. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They'd be kind of very similar to a typical druid or shaman.
Mm-hmm. And then what do we got? So we have
We got the Amethyst Order, who's my new favorite, because that's the character that I've most recently created and have been playing. And they are the Lore of Death. And similar on a lot of degrees to the god Mor. However, instead of being, they instead have a lot of similarities to Mor and necromancy, but with a very specific difference in that they're not interested in in reanimating the dead or anything like that. Instead, they are more interested in learning about death and why it happens, how it happens. So, you know, if Amethyst Wizard were cruising down the road and he sees a dead corpse, he'd probably stop and investigate it and ponder it and try and learn from it, as opposed to trying to tinker with it and reanimate it or do anything kind of nefarious. But a lot of perceptions of Amethyst Wizards are generally people are very uneasy about them because they don't really understand why someone wants to tinker with the dead, because it dabbles so closely to what are generally considered the dark arts.
Yeah, they're quite, as I understand them, they're quite shut in. They don't really like to communicate with other people. They kind of like to stay at their task at hand, and they keep themselves in their buildings and, you know, doing their little experiments.
A lot of their spells center around fear, terror, and having the shadows almost reach out and grab you.
Mm-hmm.
So generally things that would be quite terrifying. A lot of the some of the spells that I chose, for example, gives my guy fear one or fear two to everybody, anybody he targets, or generates a giant scythe out of his wand.
That wind, the amethyst wind, is known as Shyish to the wizards themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bright Wizards, the Bright Order is one that most people are familiar with, and that's the Lore of Fire.
Fire, yeah.
Specifically, these guys are pyromaniacs.
Mm, fireballs. Yes.
Very pyromaniacs.
They're known as pyromancers.
Yep.
And, you know, pyromancers are probably the most common battle wizards that are taken off to war. And the Bright Order's college is the largest of the colleges in Altdorf, and probably it receives the most funding. Most wizards are added to the Bright Wizard College. It's easily the most famous. People rise through the ranks in that college very, very quickly and easily, mostly due to other wizards being killed off in battle. But it's very, very... everything in that college has to do with fire, burning something, or creating some sort of conflagration.
Or passion, too. Like, they're very passionate and aggressive individuals. They basically...
I mean, the longer you are a Bright Wizard, your hair actually begins to turn fiery red, and these sigils and runes begin appearing on your skin. Your skin takes on a glow.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not chaos, I don't know what is, but...
Well, that is... I mean, it needs to be said that magic... is essentially, I mean, no wizard's going to admit this outright, but magic is essentially chaos. It comes
which
from
is
chaos.
Which is why the, and that in itself is why the colleges even exist. These colleges are sanctioned under control, or as much as everybody thinks it is, under control methods of teaching and controlling chaos energy.
Mm-hmm.
So generally people are relatively skeptical of wizards or afraid of them. I mean, even witch hunters don't like wizards at all. They learn to tolerate some, or at least hold back their opinions, because everybody recognizes the need for it.
Mm-hmm. They're waiting for the moment when a wizard kind of goes rogue so they can hunt them down. Mm-hmm. Mind you, you couldn't really burn a bright wizard at the stake.
They'd love it. So the Celestial Order is the fourth one. That is that has to do with the lore of heavens.
Yeah.
And that the Celestial Order is largely centered around seeing into the future, you know, trying to read the stars. They have a large orrery. Is that how you pronounce that? And up in their college, they have a secret college that's invisible that you have to know how to find. Yeah. And they don't even let their apprentices know that they're there. If the apprentice can foresee the future enough to know that he's supposed to go, mm-hmm. it may be that he was supposed to be an apprentice. You know, if he knows how to open the door, which there's no door handle on, and happened to be there at the particular time when that door appeared, because he knew ahead of time that's when it was going to be there, it's this very kind of cool kind of foreseeing into the future thing. And it's also very fashionable to have a celestial wizard in a formal court, or in a mm-hmm. you know, in a mansion or a manor. A well-off noble would almost have him as a fixture in his court.
Yeah, its color is blue, and the wind is known as Azir. And yeah, they're all about like telescopes and studying the stars and the movements of the celestial bodies and stuff like that.
Now, the Gold Order is one that I find a little confusing. I don't know about you guys, but the Gold Order is the lore of metal, and apparently you've written down that it's Michael Jackson's favorite wind.
That's
why is that?
That's because the wind is called Shalom. But never mind. There you go.
And then, so gold wizards are called alchemists, and they're easily the richest guild, but their main purpose is as alchemists, they are trying to discover how to turn any metal or element into gold. And this order receives a tremendous amount of funding from the Empire, because if they can ever successfully do this, they'll have essentially infinite money. Now, they've never actually done it, but a lot of wealthy businessmen, nobles, and other kind of patrons are always, you know, funneling money into this order in order to hopefully one day get the dividends paid back to them once they've succeeded.
I guess my biggest question is, don't they realize that if they just had infinite amounts of gold, that gold would have no value, and therefore they go into a recession and then a depression, and then never mind.
They just print more money.
That's yeah, a little they just bit make of, more and more.
Yeah, they just print more money. That's a modern take on the Warhammer.
A lot of the gold wizard spells center around manipulating metals to help either protect them or as an offensive a bit. So like maybe a protective spell might be a series of floating orbs circling around the wizard, fending off blows.
Well, they can completely melt somebody's armor too, from what I understand. They can like make their armor easy to pass through and stuff like that. If you're wearing metal armor, you're highly susceptible to a gold wizard of the Gold Order. Yeah, because he can manipulate your sword. He can like bend your sword so it doesn't work and stuff like that. I don't know if they can do that in the game as far as the spells that are made.
There are some spells that
in the lore that is the case.
There are some spells that hurt creatures based on the amount of armor they're wearing. Whereas a knight clad in full armor would be actually at quite a disadvantage when fighting a gold wizard, because his armor and all that metal would actually work against him, because he could heat it up and melt him from the inside, while somebody wearing leather armor would be relatively safe. The Grey Order, which is the lore of shadows, that would be our fifth order, and they are called illusionists.
Mm-hmm.
And their spells largely focus around creating sounds, altering light, stabbing into one shadow and having it come out of another one to stab someone in the back. They're really a very secretive one. There's not a lot. They're kind of, I almost want to call them the Thieves Guild of the magic users. The next one, which I find interesting, is the Jade Order. And the Jade Order are the Elementalists. These are, most of the Warhammer Wizard Orders are not, the Water Order or the Fire Order, with the exception of the Bright Wizards. This is really the only order that really centers around control of the elements. So storms, water, earth, the entanglement spells, kind of the spells you traditionally see in a normal role-playing game, they kind of get thrown into this Jade Order.
Yeah, the lore of life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's the elementalists, as I understand it, are kind of like druids. Whereas the lore of beasts are centered around amber, wizards are centered around animals, the Jade Orders are centered around plants, and like you said, earth and the elements, apart from fire.
And then the last order is the Light Order, and they are known as Hierophants. And the Light Order is kind of like they're the order that everybody seems to like. They're the one that kind of binds everybody together. They're the ones that have the most political face and tend to have the best reputation amongst all the colleges and their connection with the emperor and the rest of the kind of the empire. It's not uncommon for the Light Order to kind of represent another college or kind of do any kind of political dealings that would be needed.
Yeah, their college is actually a giant pyramid in the middle of Altdorf. And they have a group. It's weird because they seem to be altruistic, but not really at the same time, because there are wizards who are kind of, they'll find people who have access to or the ability to manipulate the winds of magic, but are maybe not necessarily the most powerful of users, and they will kind of use them, and they'll take them into their order and have them basically stand around in a circle, and there are hundreds of them in the pyramid who stand around in this circle, and they chant this eternal song, basically, and that's kind of helps bring the lore of light to this pyramid. They also have the ability to heal slightly.
Yeah, I was going to say, Yeah, very few wizards have the ability to do any kind of healing, and this is really, with the exception of a point here or there, this is the only major one that has that option.
Mm-hmm.
And for how few options there are for healing in Warhammer, that's actually a big deal.
Yeah, the whole idea of healing is kind of, it's an esoteric idea for sure.
So then, Lester, do you want to get into a little bit on how these colleges of magic are structured?
So there's a basic structure breakdown. Now, this isn't necessarily the case throughout all of the orders, because some of them are a little bit more loose than others. They're not as organized or rigid in their organization, I should say. But for the most part, the way it is broken down goes like this. And as I say these, they climb up in rank, basically. So a rank one wizard would be called an apprentice. And apprentices basically have the... Think of what was that Mickey Mouse show with all the music, and he's all like
Mickey Mouse.
Well, he's all like bibbidi bobbidi boo, and he makes the
Fantasia.
That's Fantasia.
Yeah, the apprentice is basically the guy who cleans up after the actual wizard and helps him in his research and does all the gopher kind of work, and the more mundane tasks are laid upon the apprentice. Once the apprentice proves himself, they become an acolyte. And an acolyte, that pretty much the majority of wizards who've actually been accepted into the order are called acolytes, and they would be rank two wizards. And to become a full-blown wizard, you'd have to get to the third rank, and they have quite a bit of power and standing within the college itself, and they're looking for new ways of they're creating new spells and doing all sorts of magical experiments all the time. And then it gets a little bit strange, because at the fourth rank it kind of breaks off. Once you get to that point in the hierarchy, you either choose to be a battle wizard, and those wizards basically go off and they're assigned to the military, and they go and fight with the imperial military against all manner of foes. And then, or you become a master wizard. And master wizards are kind of more like the desk job guys. They stay and oversee a lot of different magical research and things like that. And then once you pass that, if you survive being a battle wizard, or if you manage to make it beyond being a master wizard, you become a wizard lord, which is the fifth rank of wizards. And they are very, very, very powerful. And there are actually only a handful of wizard lords in each of the different colleges of magic. And then the person who's at the highest of that is considered the patriarch. And they are a wizard lord, but they are basically chosen. And it's different for each of the colleges. But they are chosen to, one of is chosen usually through a wizard's duel or something like that, but they're chosen to be the patriarch of the order. And all of the eight orders are overseen by one man, or woman, known as the supreme patriarch. And he is the person that, basically represents all of the colleges. That would be the person who deals with the emperor and stuff like that. And currently, the guy's name is Balthazar Gelt, and he's a gold wizard, and he won it in a magical duel.
He's the one on the cover of the Winds of Magic book.
Yeah, he looks bad.
He's pretty badass.
Cool. Well, let's take a quick break, and when we get back, we're going to do a quick Q&A session. We're getting close to an hour mark, so we're going to cut this section a little short this week, and then we'll close it off with some final comments.
As always, you can submit your questions and comments to recklessdice@gmail.com or on our Facebook under Reckless Dice, or possibly hit us up on Twitter at Reckless Dice. So, guys, today we got a couple. One of them basically is from Oba. And actually, I think he's kind of directing this towards you, Jesse. Just basically asking you, you come up with stuff for Chaos Stars, but rarely for Comets. Why is that?
Oh, is that so? I'm assuming that's in reference to some of our live sessions. Actually, it's a really good question. Chaos Stars are a lot of fun, and I'd be interested to hear your guys' take on this too. But the Chaos Stars are fun, quirky ways to add negative effects, and then rarely do I add quirky or neat positive effects for comets. Not really intentional, actually. Usually, the most times I see comets are generally in a combat role. And in that capacity, they'll trigger off a critical hit. What's less common is seeing a comet in some kind of action or social role. And honestly, I think comets are really hard to think of really great, exciting ways to create a success. Failures are so much more creative in my mind. Yeah. And maybe I just need some neat examples of what I could use.
Well, yeah, send us some examples.
Yeah, I was like, there you go. Yeah, I'd love to hear what you guys are using for creative critical successes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everybody always thinks
outside of combat.
Yeah, of the more diabolical things that happens when you have the Chaos Stars, but I don't think anybody really.
But I mean, let's say I'm climbing a ladder and I roll a critical success. What do I do? What would you guys throw in there?
Yeah, I think that'd be pretty interesting.
I mean, the best I can think of is, you know, maybe recover a fatigue because you did it so deftly. But I'm sure there's something far more creative or interesting that we can come up with. Yeah, I'd love to hear the listeners' feedback on that one.
Yeah, so guys, send us your feedback. And I think we would be really interested to see what you guys have for those comments. So the last question is from Yasbrid, and I hope I pronounced that right. So I guess it's coming from a new player coming into the game. They're just asking us, guys, if we have any tips for playing games one-on-one.
Okay, this one is from the forums. Yasbrid had asked, a lot of people like to play, or a lot of people are looking for ways to introduce Warhammer to new players. And often that comes into a, you know, hey, can I teach you how to play? Let's do a one-on-one game. And he was looking for tips on playing a one-on-one game. What would you do differently than playing a game with a full group of maybe three or four people? And so, Lester, have you done any one-on-one games?
Done lots of one-on-one games. Yeah.
So how do you generally operate them?
Well, usually what I do is I add, I'll add an NPC character to go along with the other person, with like the main player who I'm playing with. Yeah, and absolutely. That gives me, because I don't often get away, I don't often get very many chances to play the game. I'm pretty much always the game master when I play locally. So that gives me a chance to play, but I also like to allow them to make decisions for the NPC if they want, like to be like, well, it would be cool if he went over here, so that they kind of get an idea and they can kind of fill two roles at one time. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's just a really good way of focusing on it. And I like to really put them into situations where they get to experience all the different mechanics of the game. And then I can break it down much more effectively to the one person. I can teach them how fatigue and stress works, how insanity works and stuff like that. So when we get into a group, they can actually, I'm not constantly explaining the rules to people. I think that's the best utility for one-on-one games. Is to really focus on the rules. It's a really good way of getting people to understand them because you can focus on the one person.
And they also don't have, I mean, the one-on-one games are a benefit because that new player doesn't have the detriment of feeling intimidated by other people mm-hmm. who may already know the game.
Precisely.
And usually if it's a one-on-one game, that person is either, well, obviously they're going to be new to Warhammer, maybe as a setting or as a rule set, but they may also be a new player just to role playing in general. So you have a lot of benefits in order to help get them accustomed to how to play. And that use of the NPC character that you are controlling can give them examples mm-hmm. of almost how to play, because you can show them, hey, this is how somebody could interact with people. You could help drive your story along and keep it a little more controlled with that NPC.
Plus,
and
they don't have to wait. They don't have to wait around for everybody else to make decisions, right? It's much more That's involved.
True. Well, and like, also, you know, when you have NPCs, it's also allowing the person to really kind of put an edge on the character and really allow that person to elaborate more into the session. You know, because sometimes seasoned vets kind of take it a long avenue, which for new players, they're kind of like, what? You know, they get lost. Yeah. And I think that if you have that NPC character kind of be at their pace, I think it allows them to kind of go, oh, okay, I'm mm-hmm. getting, and it kind of gets them more comfortable where they're going to break open that shell and, you know, they're going to start to be like, oh, well, cool, I could do this, you know, because some people, they don't know, you know, they're not seasoned veterans. They don't know all the quirky lingos or, you know, or cool sayings that people use, you know, they're like, oh, what's that mean, you know? So I think after a person plays with a couple NPCs, they kind of gain their momentum, they become a little bit more, at a set pace, mm-hmm. so when they get into a larger group, they're not kind of like twiddling their yeah. thumbs because they're nervous.
Because they know? Get a chance to be the focal point, which is good, you know?
Well, Dan, you want to close this out?
That's a wrap for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. So be sure to comment on the site, recklessdice.com, or shoot us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com, and follow us on Twitter or Facebook @recklessdice. You guys all have a good night.